At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Okay, let's unpack this. Did you know Nicolas Cage once nearly died inside his own pyramid?
His own pyramid, you mean?
Yeah, we're talking about an actual full-scale replica right there in his backyard.
Wow, okay.
Oh.
That's quite an opening hook.
Right, and look, this isn't just some quirky celebrity anecdote, though it definitely sounds like one on the surface.
I can imagine.
This story, it really plunges us into the depths of human fascination, you know, the incredible power of belief, and the unexpected, very real dangers that can pop up when those two things collide.
Right, when fascination tips over.
Exactly. So you've got this eccentric celebrity, this truly bizarre and frankly profound obsession with ancient Egypt, and then this brush with death that honestly reads like something out of a modern myth.
So where are we getting the details on this? It sounds almost too strange to be true.
Well, today we're taking a deep dive into the whole compelling narrative of Nicolas Cage's profound immersion in ancient Egyptian lore. Our main guide for the actual events is this really captivating article called "The Day Nicolas Cage Almost Died in His Own Tomb."
Catchy title. Sets the scene.
It does. But what makes this deep dive really unique, what lets us kind of peel back the layers here, is how we're going to explore it. We're using a really specific and, I think, insightful lens, the meticulous design principles of psychological horror.
Psychological horror.
Right.
How does that connect to Nicolas Cage in a pyramid?
Bear with me. We've got excerpts from documents for a fictional series called Inspector Story.
Okay, fictional.
Right, fictional. Specifically from Designing Unseen Horrors, Inspector Story's guidebook, and Inspector Story, a cinematic horror podcast guide.
Huh. So using horror theory to analyze a real-life event, that's an interesting angle.
Exactly. So our mission today isn't just to recount the, you know, the shocking facts themselves, which are pretty wild.
Right.
But to really try and understand the why. Why did this happen? We're delving into the depths of his intense obsession, looking at how he constructed his own reality.
Yeah.
And seeing how the elements of his near-death story, well, they eerily echo the very structures that create compelling unseen terror in fiction.
So what can fictional horror tell us about real life? Self-endangerment.
That's the question, right? What chilling insights can these guidebooks, originally made for crafting dread and stories, offer us about a true story that really blurs the lines between reality and something far more unsettling? Something almost, yeah, like it was designed to be horrifying.
You know, what's truly fascinating there, as you point out, is how reality can sometimes just present these scenarios that perfectly embody the principles of crafted dread. It happens.
Right. Life imitating art, or maybe just tapping into the same primal fears.
Exactly. By examining Cage's experience alongside these theoretical frameworks for horror, we can perhaps gain a much deeper understanding.
Of what specifically?
Of the psychological impact of his actions, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, of his near-fatal encounter itself. This real-life event, it almost serves as a compelling, if, you know, completely accidental case study for the kind of subtle, creeping terror these documents describe.
Like a found footage horror film, but it actually happened.
Sort of, yeah. It's a chilling example of what happens when the internal world of belief meticulously constructed, deeply held slams into the external world's unforgiving laws, or even just its simple mechanical failures.
That's a sobering thought.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What unseen forces he truly confronted in that pyramid, even if they were ultimately of his own making.
Okay, so let's set the scene. Let's go back to 2010. This is when, according to the accounts we have, the intensity of his obsession truly peaked for Nicolas Cage.
Right, the tipping point.
Yeah. He apparently became absolutely convinced, not just interested, but convinced that he was a reincarnated pharaoh.
A pharaoh. Okay. That's specific.
Isn't it? Now, you probably know him for his notoriously wild collecting habits, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Dinosaur skulls, castles, comic books. The list goes on. He's definitely known for unique acquisitions.
Exactly. He's always been an enthusiast of the unusual, the antique, the profoundly specific. But this This Pharaoh thing, it took his eccentricity to, well, truly dangerous extremes.
Oh, so dangerous.
Because it transformed a passion for ancient history, something many people share, into a profound life-altering belief that fundamentally reshaped his entire reality, his very identity.
Well, it wasn't just, I like Egypt. It was, I am Egypt, in a way.
Pretty much. It was this monumental leap from just collecting artifacts to actually, in his mind, embodying history itself.
That's a huge internal shift.
It really is. And it makes you wonder about the human psyche, doesn't it? We all have passions, things that captivate us.
Sure. Hobbies, interests.
Right. Whether it's a hobby, a historical period, a particular band, whatever. But when does that passion, that deep interest, become an all-consuming belief that starts to shape your entire reality?
Yeah. When does it cross the line from enthusiasm to... Yeah. Something else.
Exactly. When does it transform you? Almost to the point where you feel like a different person, changing your very sense of self.
Mm.
What's that psychological journey like? To go from being an observer of history to genuinely believing you are a participant, an echo from a distant past.
Well, that's a profound observation. Because if we connect this belief to the bigger picture, the idea of reincarnation, especially as a figure of such, you know, historical power and mystique like a pharaoh.
Yeah.
It really speaks to a very deep, almost existential identity exploration.
Trying to find meaning, maybe, or a bigger narrative.
Perhaps. Especially for a public figure.
Yeah.
Someone who lives under constant scrutiny, the pressures of modern celebrity. Maybe it offers a unique sense of self.
A story that's grander than Hollywood.
Exactly. A narrative far grander and more enduring than fleeting fame. It's this deliberate, conscious stepping into a new ancient persona.
Like method acting for your own life.
In a way, yeah. It's a complete rewrite of one's own life story, providing this almost mythical lineage. It could offer a sense of control over identity, something often lost in the public eye.
That makes a certain kind of sense. Control in a chaotic world.
And if we bring in that analytical perspective from psychological horror, such a deep-seated belief held so internally.
Yeah, the inspector's story stuff.
Right. It could be a foundation for what the guidebook calls memory distortion or even pattern logic.
Okay, break those down. Memory distortion.
It isn't just forgetting things. It's more subtle, maybe more insidious. It's like a reshaping of your own past or even how you see the present. So it all aligns perfectly with this overriding internal narrative.
So he might not just think he's a pharaoh, but actually feel like he remembers things.
Potentially. Genuinely feeling ancient memories surface, experiencing them with startling clarity, or maybe misinterpreting modern events, a weird coincidence, a vivid dream, seeing them as signs or omens from his past life.
Wow. Like his mind is actively editing his own history.
Unconsciously, perhaps. And then there's pattern logic.
Okay, what's that?
Within this framework, it refers to how the mind, when it's under the sway of such a powerful, all-encompassing belief, starts to see connections and systems everywhere. Even where they don't objectively exist.
Finding meaning in everything, relating it back to the core belief.
Precisely. It weaves together disparate facts, observations, coincidences into this perfectly coherent, yet entirely self-contained logic for that individual.
So his everyday choices.
Right. From what he eats to, well, building a giant pyramid, they would all fit perfectly into his pharaonic schema, regardless of how bizarre they look to outsiders.
So he wouldn't see his actions as eccentric at all?
Probably not. He might see them as logical, maybe even divinely ordained steps in his ongoing ancient journey. It becomes a self-reinforcing loop of belief. Everything confirms the core idea.
Which brings us to the pyramid itself, because this is where it just transcends any kind of mental exercise and becomes, like, well, truly astonishing.
The physical manifestation.
Oh, yeah. Cage put his money where his belief was, and then some. Our sources reveal he spent a staggering $2.7
million. $2.7
million. Million. To build an exact replica of the Great Pyramid in his very own backyard, in Las Vegas, no less.
An exact replica, not just like inspired by.
Exact. Think about that commitment. Not a scaled-down model, not a symbolic statue, an architectural marvel of ancient engineering reproduced on private property.
That's mind-boggling, the sheer scale of it for a private individual.
Right. This wasn't just a whimsical folly. It feels like this monumental, deeply serious testament to a personal conviction, an attempt to literally manifest a historical belief into concrete reality.
It's like creating, as you said earlier, a personal theme park dedicated to your deepest belief.
Yeah.
But one with the weight of ancient history.
Exactly. It transforms the landscape of his home into this personal archaeological site. Profoundly personal, yet resonant with thousands of years of history.
It's a declaration in stone, isn't it?
Yeah.
His internal reality becoming irrevocably his external reality.
No question.
And that's a crucial point, because this isn't just about personal taste for aesthetics. It raises an important question that those Inspector Story design principles really highlight.
Which?
The focus on details that feel like part of a bigger unseen mechanism. Why such an exact replica? Why not just an approximation or something symbolic?
Good question. What do you think?
Well, it suggests it's not just a prop in his mind. It's an attempt to literally recreate an ancient sacred space, a vessel designed to facilitate a specific, profound spiritual journey.
Like the authenticity itself holds power.
That seems to be the implication. A belief that the accuracy of the structure is essential for whatever ritual or transformation he envisioned to be effective. It has to be real.
And that drive for authenticity didn't stop with the building itself, did it?
Not at all. The accounts detailed that he hired real Egyptologists, actual experts in their field.
To do what, consult?
To teach him mummification techniques.
Well, mummification, seriously?
Seriously, and not just theoretically, you understand, practically, on dead animals.
Okay, that is intense. That goes way beyond collecting artifacts.
Absolutely. It signals this desire for absolute, unwavering authenticity in practice, a direct, hands-on application of the ancient arts.
It really blurred the lines, didn't it, between being an enthusiast and becoming an ancient practitioner.
Completely. Actively engaging in rituals, these incredibly complex and, let's face it, morbid rites that have been dormant for millennia. This wasn't a casual interest. He was actively physically participating.
So how does that connect back to the horror framework, the mummification practice?
Well, in the context of Inspector's Story, the focus on such meticulous, almost obsessive details, the exact replica, the genuine expertise, the actual practice of mummification.
Yeah.
It all contributes to this sense that everything is part of something larger, a system, even if it's a self-created one, a system that few others understand.
Like building his own secret world with its own rules.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It creates this world where ancient rituals are being meticulously and, frankly, unsettlingly brought into a modern backyard. It establishes this hidden logic, an internal coherence to his actions.
Baffling from the outside, but maybe making perfect sense within his constructed pheromonic reality?
Exactly. It makes the impossible feel real, tangible, and that blurring of reality is a really powerful horror device. It makes you question what's possible.
And the immersion didn't stop with the pyramid or the rituals. It got even more personal.
How so?
He started sleeping in a custom sarcophagus.
Sleeping in it? Like, as his bed?
As his bed. Made from authentic limestone, apparently. This wasn't just, you know, decoration in the corner of the room.
Wow.
This was his bed. His private sanctuary. His, well, you have to say it, his personal tomb.
That level of integration into daily life is remarkable.
It really is. Taking this belief into the most intimate part of his daily life, the very place he rests and recharges, it speaks to this all-consuming, undeniable immersion. He chose to spend his nights in the vessel of the dead.
Sleeping in a stone coffin every night.
Can you imagine? What does that do to your psyche? How does that choice redefine your understanding of comfort, of safety, even the idea of rest itself?
Does sleep become something else entirely? A rehearsal for the afterlife?
Mm-hmm.
A journey?
Or just a constant reminder of mortality? Or maybe, for him, a reconnection with a perceived past. It's such a profound act, pushing the boundaries of identity.
To choose to sleep in a sarcophagus, especially one of authentic limestone, It suggests this complete and utter integration of the pharaonic belief into every fiber of his daily existence.
No turning back psychologically.
It seems like it. It's a profound physical manifestation of his chosen identity. A constant, tangible reminder of mortality in the afterlife, yes, but maybe also a powerful symbol of preservation and enduring power, like the pharaohs themselves.
So every night becomes a ritual.
Exactly. A ritualistic re-entry into that identity. It creates an internal memory loop. That's a concept the Inspector Story Guide explores.
A memory loop.
Yeah, where every night reinforces the core belief, the chosen reality, embedding it ever deeper into his subconscious. The act itself becomes this nightly affirmation, not just, you know, quirky choice of furniture.
So how does the memory loop work in horror?
The Inspector Story Guide talks about psychological horror devices like these loops. Imagine a character who feels like they've been somewhere before or done something before, but maybe something slightly off.
Deja vu, but unsettling.
More than that. As the guide puts it, she'd already been here, but the room had changed. It's a deliberate mechanism to make reality feel unstable, to suggest some hidden force is altering perceptions.
Okay, I see. So for Cage.
For Cage, sleeping in that sarcophagus every night, it's this constant ritualistic re-entry into a tomb state.
Yeah.
He's not just resting. He's, in his mind, maybe experiencing this profound memory loop that continually reinforces his pharaonic identity.
Blurring the lines between his current life and his past lives.
Exactly. Making the abstract concept of reincarnation concrete and inescapable through daily repetition. The external world, his bedroom, had finally physically caught up to his internal conviction. It's a powerful self-reinforcing cycle.
Yeah. So we have the belief, the pyramid, the sarcophagus, the mummification practice, this whole incredibly immersive world he's built.
A complete commitment.
And this obsession, this journey of self-transformation and architectural manifestation, it all culminates in what our source calls a spiritual test.
A test.
Yeah. And this is where the story takes a truly dark turn. It moves from, you know, mere eccentricity, however extreme, to genuine life-threatening peril.
Okay. What did he do?
He made the decision to seal himself inside his pyramid tomb.
Seal himself inside. For how long?
For a full 72 hours. 3 days.
Wow. Completely sealed in.
Completely sealed in. This wasn't just for a nap or even like a brief meditation session. This was a full 3-day endurance test.
With what? Provisions.
Minimal. Only water and ancient Egyptian bread for sustenance.
Ancient Egyptian bread. He really committed to the theme.
Didn't he? It's this deliberate, extreme act of self-imposed isolation and deprivation. A complete surrender to the environment he had so meticulously created.
Pushing himself to the absolute limit.
Exactly. And it makes you ask, what kind of spiritual revelation, what profound confirmation could someone possibly be seeking in that kind of extreme isolation and deprivation?
What do you hope to find when you strip everything away like that?
Right. What are the true limits of such a test, not just physically, but psychologically? And what do you expect to find when you're left alone with only your thoughts and the stark reality of a self-made tomb?
Is it enlightenment you're seeking?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it something far more unsettling you might encounter in that state?
That's the terrifying question.
Well, this act, as you describe it, it's incredibly profound, a self-imposed test that really pushes the limits of human endurance, mental fortitude, everything.
Like it's a crucible.
Absolutely. It's an act of deliberate, almost monastic isolation, stripping away all modern comforts in pursuit of some deeper understanding or maybe that final undeniable confirmation of his beliefs.
And the details, the bread and water.
They aren't just sustenance, are they? They're part of the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Meticulously connecting him to that historical, almost sacred context, intended to purify, to focus the mind, maybe prepare it for revelation.
Like a modern reenactment of an ancient rite of passage.
Exactly. A pilgrimage within his own backyard designed to cross some kind of threshold to break through.
So how does the setup look from the inspector story perspective, the sealed tomb, the isolation?
Oh, it creates an absolutely ideal environment for unseen horrors, prime territory.
How so?
The whole premise in horror design, especially psychological horror, is that silence is suspicious, shadows mean something, and crucially, dead air is not a gap, it's tension.
Explain that dead air part.
It means silence isn't just an absence of sound. In horror, it's a deliberate active force. It's designed to make you anticipate something dreadful, to build this palpable unease.
The quiet before the storm.
Kind of. So a sealed pyramid with only the sound of your own breathing, maybe your own heartbeat, and this mounting oppressive silence, it amplifies every tiny internal sensation, every creak or shift, transforming it into a potential encroaching threat.
Your own mind becomes the monster.
Potentially. The self-imposed parameters, the isolation, the darkness. They craft this perfect container for psychological dread. The mind, left entirely to its own devices, can, and often does, conjure its own demons. The stage was absolutely set for a truly internal horror.
But it wasn't just internal horror he faced, was it? The meticulously designed spiritual vessel, it had a flaw.
A flaw in the pyramid?
A fatal flaw. An unseen crack in its sacred facade. Our source states that the ventilation system...
The modern necessity in the ancient design.
Exactly. The ventilation system malfunctioned during the night.
Oh no, while he was sealed inside.
While he was sealed inside. So he wasn't just in darkness, isolated, hungry, maybe waiting for some spiritual communion.
He was.
He was in that profound, absolute darkness, slowly suffocating.
Suffocating, wow.
Imagine the mounting, visceral terror of that realization. alone in your self-made tomb, as the very air, the most basic fundamental necessity for life,
starts to run out,
slowly becomes this finite disappearing resource. It's turning against you, silently, insidiously.
A betrayal by the very structure meant to save him or elevate him.
Exactly. The sanctuary had become a suffocating trap. The thing designed for his spiritual journey was now killing him.
That creeping dread, the agonizing slowness of it. As the air thins, your breath gets harder.
Each gasp less effective, your body crying out for something that just isn't there anymore.
The claustrophobia, the absolute darkness, the growing desperation. That's a truly chilling scenario.
Way more terrifying than any sudden monster jumping out, right? It's a horror that preys on your most fundamental instinct for survival.
Turning your own body into the enemy. Struggling against this invisible assailant.
Yeah.
Just, wow.
Yeah.
You know, this is a perfect, absolutely terrifying example of ambient horror, yeah, as described in those Inspector Story guidelines.
Ambient horror.
Yeah, it's not about a monster jumping out. It's about the environment itself becoming hostile, slowly corrupting, turning against you.
Like the house in a haunted house story.
Exactly. The guide states, some entities are ambient. They don't appear. They corrupt. Here, the entity wasn't a ghost, not a physical attacker. It was the air itself.
Silently corrupting, becoming hostile.
Insidious. The life-giving force just slowly withdrawn. And the slow suffocation, the complete darkness, they just amplify the psychological torment. Makes it so much worse than an overt, sudden threat.
It's an internal siege.
Precisely. A battle for survival against the invisible, against the essential elements of life itself. The horror is in the deprivation, the insidious withdrawal, the slow, agonizing realization that your environment is killing you.
And the sounds, or lack of them.
Right. The audio and atmosphere guidelines for a Spectre story speak directly to this. They talk about minimal, unsettling audio cues.
Like what?
Long silences, reverse sounds, off-frequency distortion, low hum, slow tape drag. Things that just feel wrong.
So, in that sealed pyramid.
The increasing absence of fresh air, the mounting quiet. Broken only perhaps by the sound of his own breathing getting louder, more labored, more desperate in that oppressive silence.
Well,
those become the ultimate analog terror textures. The environment itself, once his sanctuary for transcendence, became the antagonist, a silent, unseen killer operating on the most primal level, using the very conditions of his self-imposed test against him.
So how did he get out? He obviously survived.
Well, luckily, or perhaps, ironically,
yeah,
there was an outside intervention. Something that violently broke through the sacred quiet of his test.
The real world crashing in.
Completely. Our source details that his panicked assistant, someone must have known he was in there, maybe he had instructions.
Right, must have been checking.
Had to call the fire department.
The fire department, to get into a pyramid.
Apparently, they found Cage barely conscious, gasping for air. But only after they had to physically break into the pyramid to get to him.
Break into his sacred tomb.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The dramatic, forceful rescue just shatters the illusion of the self-contained spiritual test. Rips through that carefully constructed reality he'd built.
A sudden, jarring intrusion of the mundane yet life-saving world.
A stark return to a reality he had tried so hard and so expensively to escape.
The irony there is just. It's palpable. His personal sanctuary, meticulously designed to elevate him, became his trap, almost his grave.
The very place intended for transcendence nearly brought about his end through essentially a mechanical failure.
It's this profound clash, isn't it? Spiritual ambition versus the brutal, indifferent physics of the real world. Air conditioning breaks, people suffocate.
And the intervention of the fire department, having to literally break into what was meant as this sacred, inviolable space, it just highlights that stark contrast.
Spiritual aspiration versus mundane, life-saving necessity.
It's a jarring, almost violent collision of worlds. And the ventilation system itself, this unseen modern mechanism designed for safety within the ancient structure, ironically becomes the instrument of peril.
Highlighting this fundamental technological failure within the system he created to house his beliefs.
A mundane error in a spiritual quest that almost proved fatal. It just underscores the fragility of these constructed realities.
And how does this fit with the Inspector Story ideas about systems?
Well, it echoes that concept that everything is part of something larger, a system, a cover-up, a pattern, a test. Here, the system of the pyramid's engineering designed to support life during his test tragically failed.
Revealing a critical, unseen vulnerability.
Exactly. The very mechanisms intended to facilitate his quest almost ended it. It demonstrates that even carefully planned systems, especially those built on the edge of the esoteric, can harbor these deadly unseen flaws.
Reality bites back.
It's a testament to the unpredictable nature of reality, even when you try meticulously design it to conform to your internal narrative.
And what about the assistant? The panicked reaction.
That's interesting, too. Through the lens of dialogue realism in horror, the guide mentions characters being rational but confused, and maybe no one reacts appropriately.
How does the assistant fit the...
Well, while Cage was undergoing his sacred test, the assistant's reaction panic, calling 911, might seem inappropriate within the context of the spiritual ritual Cage envisioned.
Right, you're supposed to let him finish the test, maybe.
But that panic, that perfectly human reaction to immediate observable danger, is what ultimately saves his life. It breaks the isolation in this very unexpected, undeniably heroic way.
So the inappropriate reaction was actually the most rational one.
Exactly. The assistant's inappropriate panic was in fact the most rational, life-affirming response imaginable in that moment. A triumph of common sense, maybe, over spiritual aspiration. Reality intervening decisively.
So he's rescued, barely conscious. What happens next? What does it all mean when you push your eccentricities, your beliefs, right to that perilous edge?
Well, the consequences were quite stark and very real world. Our source tells us this incident led directly to a court-ordered psychiatric evaluation.
Wow. Okay, from Pharaoh in training to psyche ball.
Pretty much. A stark bureaucratic reckoning for what was, for him, presumably a deeply personal spiritual endeavor.
It's the ultimate collision, isn't it? That inner world, driven by belief and ritual, slamming into external reality and its rules, its regulations about mental and physical well-being.
The public and legal systems intervening in a private spiritual quest gone wrong.
And that outcome, it really raises profound questions, doesn't it? About that often blurry line between intense passion, admirable eccentricity, and a potential dangerous break from what we collectively agree is consensual reality.
Where do we as a society draw that line? It's a tough question.
And who gets to draw it, especially when the person involved is a prominent public figure whose behavior is already seen as, well, unusual.
Right. How does society respond when a private delusion or obsession threatens to become publicly fatal?
It's heavy stuff.
It is. And this outcome, the court-ordered psychiatric evaluation, it's profoundly significant in that context.
How so?
It's society's established mechanism, imperfect as it might be, for evaluating when an individual's behavior, no matter how privately motivated, might have crossed into something perceived as dangerous, self-destructive, delusional even.
A reality check imposed from the outside.
Exactly. For Cage, it was this direct, unavoidable confrontation between his deeply held beliefs and an external clinical assessment, forcing a reevaluation of his self-perception, whether he accepted the findings or not.
It's the official world stepping in to define reality when someone's version deviates too far, especially when it puts them in danger.
A forced return to collective reality, you could say.
And how does this connect back to the Inspector Story horror concepts, the psych evil?
Well, interestingly, the guide explicitly mentions bureaucratic horror.
Bureaucratic horror, like paperwork, is scary.
Kind of, yeah. It describes it as forms, requests, internal memos from unknowable departments. The horror of impersonal systems.
Okay.
So the court-ordered evaluation, the fire department's incident report, the medical assessments, the legal documents that would undoubtedly follow.
Right. All the paperwork.
These are the mundane bureaucratic elements that ground this terrifying incident in a chilling, almost detached reality. They act as the official documentation of the incident.
Dissecting this deeply personal spiritual event with cold, hard facts and administrative procedures.
Exactly. They become the why of the official record. Reducing a near-death experience, a spiritual quest gone wrong, to a series of checkboxes, diagnoses, reports.
Which lends this unsettling credibility and finality to the whole bizarre experience. It's not just a weird story anymore, it's documented fact.
Right, the system processed it.
Now, this is where it gets really insightful, I think. Looking at the lore and thematic texture section of Inspector Story. It emphasizes focusing not just on what happened, but fundamentally on why things are documented in a particular way.
The motivation behind the record keeping.
Exactly. So in this real world context, why was this specific incident stemming from a seemingly personal eccentric obsession so impactful that it led to such a serious public intervention, like a court-ordered psyche vol?
Why did the system react so strongly?
Yeah, it wasn't just a fire rescue that got logged. It was this comprehensive societal response demanding an explanation and assessment. Why?
That why is absolutely critical here. It's not just documenting a celebrity's near-death experience, like a car crash or something.
No, it feels different.
It's documenting the dangerous culmination of an obsession, The precise point at which an individual's reality becomes a tangible, life-threatening danger to their physical existence.
So the documentation is about the risk inherent in the belief itself.
I think so. The incident forces this reflection on the fine, often imperceptible line between passionate pursuit and potentially self-destructive behavior. Where does one end and the other begin?
And the record serves as a warning, maybe.
Or at least a marker.
Yeah.
It serves as this real-world case file that, much like the ones imagined in Inspector Story, hints at deeper psychological systems at play.
Systems where the unseen power of belief can be both liberating in its scope.
And terrifyingly binding in its grip. It's a record of the precise moment an internal, private world violently collided with external, undeniable limits. And it documents the mechanism society uses to cope with that breach.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the system trying to contain the anomaly.
And the guide also states that each episode should feel like a brush with a bigger thing that refuses to be seen.
Okay, how does that apply here? What's the bigger thing?
In Nicolas Cage's story, I think that bigger thing is the profound, unseen force of his own mind. Its incredible capacity for radical immersion.
Which we saw with the pyramid, the sarcophagus.
Right. And ultimately, maybe, its capacity for self-deception, or at least a blind pursuit of a personal truth, regardless of the risks.
So his internal world, manifested externally in the pyramid,
almost became his undoing. It refused to be seen as problematic or dangerous, perhaps even by him, until it nearly claimed his life.
It's a chilling reminder, isn't it, of the powerful internal narratives we all live by.
Absolutely. And how compelling and potentially dangerous they can become when they override objective reality. It's the horror of self-created systems turning malignant.
And that haunting language, the guide suggests.
Yeah, phrases like, the tape never blinked, or he was standing in the static. You can almost apply them metaphorically here, can't you?
How so?
The pyramid stood, unblinking, this silent ancient witness, as he faced the suffocating static of disappearing air.
Chilling.
The story carries that unsettling, lingering resonance. Like a recovered, deeply disturbing file that continues to yield unsettling insights long after you first read it, reminding us of just how fragile that line between belief and delusion can be. #outro.
Wow. Okay. We've taken a truly deep dive today, haven't we? Into Nicolas Cage's extraordinary obsession, his terrifying near-death experience.
It's quite a story.
We really tried to peel back the layers of what seems like just an eccentric celebrity tale on the surface.
And using those frameworks from psychological horror,
yeah,
it really does offer a different perspective.
Yeah, I think it helped illuminate those deeper, unsettling currents beneath the surface, transforming what could be just an amusing, bizarre anecdote into something far more profound, maybe. And disturbing about the human condition.
It shifts from the merely bizarre to the genuinely frightening when you look at the mechanics of it.
Totally. So what does this all mean for us listening to this? What's the takeaway? This journey into Cage's pyramid, I think it reminds us of the incredible, sometimes dangerous, power of human belief.
Mm-hmm. The power to shape reality, for better or worse.
And that thin, almost imperceptible line between passionate pursuit, something we admire, and genuine peril.
A line that maybe he crossed without realizing it until it was almost too late.
Yeah. It's definitely a story that stays with you long after you hear the facts. It leaves this lingering sense of the uncanny, maybe.
Definitely uncanny.
And maybe a deeper appreciation for the mind's sheer ability to construct its own reality. For good and potentially for ill.
You know, this story makes us question not just the eccentric choices of one particular celebrity.
Right. It's bigger than just him.
It is. It makes us question the very nature of obsession itself. When does a deep fascination transform from a personal pursuit, something enriching, into an unseen force that threatens to consume you entirely?
That's a critical question for anyone with a passion.
It is. And what unseen ventilation systems in our own lives, maybe metaphorical ones, blind spots in our thinking, unchallenged beliefs, are we perhaps overlooking?
Mm.
Or what profound spiritual tests are we unknowingly undertaking in our own ways that could, without warning, lead to our own moment of crisis?
That's a really thought-provoking point.
Mm.
What systems are we relying on that might fail?
It truly begs the question of what boundaries we set for our own beliefs, our own pursuits.
Mm-hmm.
And when do those boundaries, or the lack of them, become dangerous?
Indeed. His obsession almost became his tomb.
A powerful closing thought.
A truly unforgettable deep dive into the human psyche and the unexpected, perilous places it can lead. Thanks for joining us for this fascinating exploration.
Thanks for having me. It was illuminating.
We look forward to delving into more intriguing topics with you next time.